At 4 p.m. in Albany, New York. We are interviewing Tom Alacco, who served in the United States Marine Corps September 7, 1967 through September 6, 1970, and in the United States Air Force Reserve from May 1982 to March 1, 2008. This interview is being conducted by Kenneth and June Hunter. Please tell us your full name and when and where you were born.
Thomas N. Alacco. I was born in Rochester, New York.
And please tell us why you entered the service.
Well, I guess I entered the service because, first of all, back I entered the service in 67 when an awful lot of people were entering the service in those days, of course. There was the draft on, they had a very large military. But I always think that I entered the service because I was born in 1948, early on in the baby boom generation, and I grew up in the 50s, in the early 60s, as a young person, just surrounded by World War II vets when they were still young and vigorous people, and World War II was still relatively close in time. When people said the war, you knew what they meant. So I think it was just for an impressionable young man, it was. I guess it was inevitable that you would think about being in the military. One of the stories that I tell is that on the street where I was first, where I was born in a hospital, but on the street where my mother brought me, where we were first living, there were only about six or eight houses, and two young men were killed in World War II on that street, and another was so severely wounded that he died in the early 50s from his wounds. Two of the people who died in this on that street, Campbell Street in Rochester, were actually relatives of our family. My father's brother and my father's first cousin, one in Saipan and one with a liberator in Yugoslavia. So growing up in that kind of an atmosphere, I think that and being somebody who was a little too restless to want to go through college, I guess it was inevitable to think about the military. So. 1967, I was actually going to a community college in the spring semester, and instead of taking a very difficult mathematics test, I went down to State Street, Rochester, and went in and talked to the recruiter, and basically signed up right on the spot. Went down and took the test and signed up, and I did a delayed thing and went in September, and got up that morning. My mother drove me down to the State Street, the federal building, and the 1965 Ford Falcon with one of those old-fashioned little gym bags. And that was an adventure because it was kind of like the World War II thing. They put us on a train. They actually bused us to Buffalo, but they put us on a train, and it was all day and all night thing down to Parris Island, South Carolina for boot camp there, and that was 1967, and it was still an unpleasant rough experience. That, you know, you hear about Marine boot camp. I wouldn't say that they really hit you a lot. They would sometimes do things like that, but it wasn't a brutal kind of a thing, but. But it was certainly rough. I don't know what it's like now, but I know it was still an unpleasant experience. Spent 3 years in the Marines. I was one of the few people at the end of boot camp that was issued a overcoat. Everybody else was going what they called Westpac, Western Pacific. And I was given an overcoat, and I was sent to Indianapolis, Indiana, Fort Benjamin Harrison, which is now closed. And I went through a journalism school in public affairs. So I didn't have quite the adventure that other people do in the Marines. I was in the United States. I was in the Air Wing at Cherry Point, North Carolina, and El Toro, California, over a period of 3 years in public affairs. And a lot of the people I was in boot camp with arrived in Vietnam just at the time of the Tet Offensive in January 68. And I do remember reading their names in, I think it was the Marine Corps Times, where they listed the casualties over there. But there was the impact of that Vietnam War, of course. Now, during my 3 years in the Marines, one of the things that I wanted to mention was I did a lot of traveling around airports and things like that. And whatever you may hear about people being spit on in airports, I can tell you that there was an awful lot, I think there was an awful lot of patriotism back then. Because here I was this young guy, 19, 20, 21, and I remember, and you wore the green uniform then. I remember guys coming up, World War II vets coming up and buying us drinks, and I have one particular memory of a veteran. He might have looked maybe a little bit like I do with a jacket like this, and he reached in his pocket and he pulled out his discharge papers from World War II. So my experiences in uniform traveling around were always positive, and I did a certain amount of traveling because I was as I say, both in North Carolina and in California. One memory that I have is spending a long time on an Army base. And you know how veterans talk about bad food? Well, it really was bad food. And just as an example, they used to serve the same meatball 2-3 times in 1 week with different names. So as far as I can testify that the food really, in the Army, the Marines and the Navy had good food, but the Army, I don't think they ever really came out of that old mentality. I never really thought that they treated their people as well as even the Marines and the Army, at least during my 3 years.
Now back to your basic training. What were some of the kinds of things you had to do? Did you have to get familiar with different kinds of weapons? What were your instructors like?
You know, they say that people respect their drill instructors, and in my case, that's true. You know, I know that we had two very tough drill instructors, both Vietnam veterans. One of them had been a machine gunner in Operation Harvest Moon, which had fairly recently taken place, which you can still read about in the history books. And I know that they were very rough with us, but they were respected, just like people say. And one of my memories was, even though it was September, maybe it wasn't the high heat of summer, it was out in a swampy area of deep south South Carolina, by the ocean. We were in t-shirts and we had these silver helmets, and we were it seemed like we were marching constantly. What I remember is the marching and the heat and the drill. That's what I remember. I remember there was a lot of mental stress too. One of the things I remember is that in a sense I didn't mind when they took us out for a run or something, because it actually got away. The mental part was harder than the physical part. They actually had a lot of schooling going on and things like that. You were given a guidebook that you were expected to learn a lot of things. There was I guess what I remember most is the things like the drill, and there was a lot of, and the PT. I remember, they were still in a wooden barracks, and with a wooden floor, and there was constant drill in that wooden barracks. I remember and the floor being soaked with sweat and everything else. There was at least one case where a recruit was abused. That I felt. So it wasn't perfect. They hadn't yet developed as sophisticated a training programs as they have now. I'll say that. I do think that on an individual basis, I think the people were good, but I think that the overall system was still primitive. Because as I said, I did see personally one thing of abuse of a recruit.
How did they abuse him, or what did they do, or what did he do that caused this? Or would you rather not?
Well, no. I mean, it's kind of sad. I mean, from his point of view. Now, this was a little bit out of character, but there was another drill instructor who probably shouldn't have been there. And what happened was, it was our last day of being in boot camp. And there's a thing called unqualified. And in the Marines, where they put so much emphasis on marksmanship, that's the worst mortal sin you can commit. He failed to qualify with the, we used M14s in those then, even though the M16 was a weapon used in Vietnam, we were training with the M14. He failed to qualify. They did a lot of bad things to him. The drill instructor did. On the last day before we were going to graduate, before we were going to complete boot camp, get on the bus and leave, we were all in the barracks, and this guy, the drill instructor from the other platoon brought this guy in, and the guy was crying. He was so humiliated. They gave us a large cloth, diaper cloth, because it was soft cotton to shine our shoes with. And he was wearing nothing but that diaper thing, and he was carrying a big rock. In other words, he was humiliated way past what he should have been. And of course, it wasn't good training. It was terrible training. So, it's true. You know, I guess in summary, it's true that from my point of view, that the drill instructors were respected. I still have a positive feeling for two out of the three drill instructors. And I still think that there were things that were absolutely wrong about the Marine training in 1967.
Can you remember back in the basic training, paydays, did you have to get your own haircuts after your initial one? What about clothing replacement? Did you have to purchase your own clothing? Did they give you an allowance for it?
I remember we didn't get paid very much. That's the part I remember. But I also remember things didn't cost very much either. I remember that that beer in the club was only 25 cents. And I remember that, it seemed like we had to spend an awful lot of money on replacing uniforms because they were very, being in the States and not being overseas, they were very strict. If there was one thread broken or something like that, they would say that shirt is unserviceable and you'd have to, and again, they gave you an allowance, but it probably wasn't really enough. You wound up spending your own money for uniform replacements. And that was kind of a nagging thing that there was this constant inspections of that we had and the constant uniforms. I know that there was, I remember very clearly talking to this one Marine one day, and he had come back from Vietnam not too long before that as an M60 machine gunner, a grunt. And he said he was going back to Vietnam, and this, I've heard other people say this too, but I know this particular person, and he said it was easier to go back to Vietnam where they didn't have all these inspections and everything that people had to put up with stateside. But
did you have Saturday reviews?
We did. There was a period of time when I was at El Toro when Saturday morning we would go out and drill on Saturday morning. I think that was part of the tightening up of discipline. What happened was that between 67 and 70, my personal experience was that there really was, they talk about how the military declined because of the stresses of Vietnam. I saw a decline in discipline between 67 and 70, between the time I came in and the time I got out. There was more people smoking marijuana. There were more people being disrespectful of the rules and things like that. I remember at El Toro, during my last time in the Marines in the summer of 70, they tried to start reinstilling some discipline. So every Saturday morning, they would have us, instead of having a day off, we would fall out and drill in the big parking lot, big facility they had there. But that's what I remember about as far as the discipline and stuff like that. I had a good job. I had a very good job. I was in the public affairs office. I had the opportunity to, one thing that gave me a lot of pleasure, I went to Camp Lejeune and did some exercises with the Marine Reservists. And normally I was with the Air Wing. And the Marine Reservists, we were out in the field. There was actually, we were driving around in Jeeps. I think they were, for training purposes, I think we were still using M1s. I know when I did infantry training after Paris Island, we were still using old World War II M1s. Matter of fact, we were still eating the sea rations that were marked from like 1945. But anyway, I didn't actually participate in it. I did have the opportunity to see a beach landing at Camp Lejeune. And I remember at night we'd be out, and you could see the fires in the hills all around us where they were practicing artillery and things like that. So while I was in California, I did have a little taste of that Marine adventure thing.
Did you have any opportunity to have rivalry with your sister service there, the Navy, at any time?
No, we didn't really have. We really didn't have anything going like that. You know, maybe because I was just stayed at the air wing there, and both at Cherry Point, North Carolina, and California. But no, I didn't have really any connection with the Navy, or any other services. I remember we didn't like the Air Force. I remember that, which is ironic because I wound up spending a lot more years in the Air Force Reserve after getting out of the Marines. And one of the things that when I was in the Air Force Reserve, I noticed that an awful lot of, even though it's such a small service, the Marines, there were a lot of former Marines, maybe because they were just military oriented, who went into the Air Force Reserve. You see a lot of people when we're wearing the dress uniforms would have the Marine Good Conduct ribbon, the red, I think it's red and black ribbon.
You mentioned wearing the green uniform. Were there ever any occasions with the blue uniform, the dress blue uniform?
The only time I had the dress blue uniform was for a Paris Island picture. No, I didn't. I never wore the dress blues. We had the green fatigues, and we had the green dress, more formal uniform. We still had the big round hats, and in those days they still had khakis, the tanned khakis that you would. So you both had the summer trousers and the winter green, and the khaki.
Can you remember leaving basic training and going home? What was the reception like back home when you got there from basic?
Well, actually, what they did you went to Paris Island, and then when you finished Paris Island, which was of course just the basic of the basic, everybody, no matter what your job was going to be, you know, every Marine is a rifleman. We went up to camp. Earlier when I was talking about California, I was saying Camp Lejeune. It was Camp Pendleton that I was at out there. I was in California. I was on the wrong coast. But when I was after Paris Island, we all went up to Camp Lejeune. There was a place called Camp Geiger. I don't know if they still use it for training, but that was pretty much in wooden hooches, and we spent 3 weeks, I guess, doing infantry training out there, living out out there, and that's again we're running around with the M1s doing infantry training. After that, then they sent us home, and actually I got home at the beginning of December, and of course it was great. It was great getting home. It was great getting away. First thing that I noticed when I got home was putting on civilian clothes, how light they felt after the heavy fit. The fatigues is what they call them in the Air Force, but after the heavy uniform, I noticed how light it was. Funny thing that happened was, unfunny thing for me at the time, was I got orders to go to Fort Benjamin Harrison, Indiana, to go to school for journalism, to arrive on December 24. Now, at the time, I didn't realize that I could have actually requested an extension or something like that, being brand new. So I arrive on December 24 after a long flight at the school, and everything is closed. I don't have what they call the chow card. You know, again, I could have fought it if I'd been more experienced. But I couldn't go eat the meal. There was no place to buy food. I had a very unpleasant December 24, and I don't know at what point I was actually able to get a meal. But I do remember sitting in a little rec room, and eating a plate of cookies or something. But for a growing young man, it wasn't a very pleasant Christmas Eve. And at some point, you know, it took a couple of days to get this chow card to be able to get decent meals. But it was an unpleasant Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. That was in Indianapolis. The other kind of unpleasant thing that happened was I came down with strep throat. And again, this was an Army base, and they were so much more primitive back then than they are now. I was sick in the barracks. Strep throat can be a pretty disabling thing. It weakens you. It's an Indiana winter. The hospital is up on top of a hill a mile or two away from the barracks. And I remember trudging up with this fever. Up, had to go to the hospital once a day to get one more pass or whatever it is to not have to to be off duty, excusal from duty. But every day I had to trudge up this hill with a fever and get one more 24-hour pass and back down, cursing the Army all the way up there and back, just for, you know, as opposed to like, why don't we just say you're sick and go to bed. And I remember some sergeant yelling at me about it and threatening me with, you know, court-martial and everything else. But I guess if there was one characteristic of my military experience, it spanned 40 years. So, after an 11-year break in service, after getting out in 1970, in 1982, I joined the Air Force Reserve. And I got to witness a long period of time when actually they really did make things an awful lot better, as far as treating people better, just having a better managerial system. One of the things that I tell people is how bad the housing was, speaking of being on active duty, both at Cherry Point and El Toro, which weren't even considered like, you know, infantry or rough kinds of places. They didn't even provide you your own bed. It was a bunk bed. And so you had you didn't even have your own space, let alone your own room. You shared that little, you had a wall locker next to somebody else's wall locker, and the two of you, you know, one was up and one was down. So, and they didn't have doors on the bathroom and in the toilets. They didn't have doors, and it wasn't that they didn't build them. You could see where they actually had removed them. You know, whatever military policy that was. So, my point here is when I got out, when I completed my Air Force Reserve service in 2008, everybody was given private rooms. Everybody is getting microwave ovens. Everybody is has control of their own heat in the room. We have in the reserve, we had maids coming in every single day to make your bed. So I went from, they took the doors off the toilets and not even having my own bed, basically having, you know, a bunk bed, which really wasn't necessary because this was a base in the United States. It wasn't like it was off at, you know, in some place in Vietnam or something like that. Anyway, I went from a bunk bed to having a microwave oven. And I'll tell you, I did appreciate that. And which leads me to another point. In the Air Force Reserve, I made four trips on the C-5 Galaxy, the biggest cargo plane in the free world, to the Middle East during Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and also during Operation Iraqi Freedom. And the one of the times that I went there, I had what I thought was an interesting experience. I was absolutely amazed at how good the food was over there. I complained about the Army. The Army would, when I was on active duty, gave us meatballs a couple of times a week, and then they would make them different names, you know, to pretend that they were serving you different food. I was in Saudi Arabia. I was at a big air base in Saudi Arabia, and the food was like every single thing you could want, from eggs to steak any kind of food that you wanted. If you wanted pork, if you wanted chicken, and it was all like, take as much as you want. It was all unlimited. They used third world people behind the counters. I think it was Filipinos and stuff. But it was, this was in 1990 when I was over there. But the point of what I'm saying is, I remember walking down the street on that base and thinking, boy, these kids today have it made. And I heard two young airmen saying, I'm going out and buy pizza, complaining about the bad food over at the mess hall. So I guess some of it is perspective. When I was stationed on an Army base for a year, they said that you would be punished with an Article 15 if you took seconds. You could take seconds on salad, but if you took seconds on something in the food line. So my point is, compared to those two kids over in Saudi Arabia, I wanted to say to them, I remember when I would be grateful just to be able to get enough calories to eat out of the stingy guys back in the 60s. So I did see some huge changes over the years.
Now, you had been serving in the Marines, and then you went into the Air Force after a period of time. What did you do, and why did you leave the Marines, and what did you do before you went into the Air Force?
Well, they talk about people getting their training and stuff, learning a job skill in the military, and that's what happened to me. I went in the Marines. They sent me to journalism school, and I've spent the rest of my life in some form of public relations basically since then. In the time between being in the Marines and joining the Air Force Reserve, I graduated from a journalism program at Buffalo State College, and I got a job on a weekly newspaper and worked there for quite a number of years. And then at that point I was writing for and editing for a chain of weekly newspapers around Buffalo. And that's the point when I had been thinking about the military, just having an interest in the military, military history and everything else. And as I say, still always that son of the World War II generation kind of thing, that whole baby boom thing. And somebody told me about the an air base up at Niagara Falls, which I didn't know about, C-130 Air Base. I kind of expressed an interest in it, and I was home. And on a Saturday morning, I got a call from a recruiter, and almost before I knew it, kind of a thing. He said, "Why don't you just come down and take the AFES test, the Army, I don't know what AFES, Army Air Force." I'm mistaken. It's not, AFES is the PX system.
It's a battery of tests.
Yeah, the battery of tests for the. A battery test. It went down to the federal building, took it. Anyway, before I knew it, I was back in the Air Force Reserve at Niagara Falls, where they had C-130s, which they still have. 914th, at that time, was called the 914th Tactical Airlift Group. I think it's called the 914th Airlift Wing now. But they fly C-130s, a Hercules. It's a tactical airplane, four propellers, and I went in for 1 year, and the second time around I re-enlisted for the full shot. I knew that that's what I wanted to do, at least as far as a part-time job. As soon as I went in, I enjoyed the camaraderie. I enjoyed the being around the airplanes and the adventure, and doing something kind of big and fun. Just a great part-time job. I was in public affairs. Public affairs. It, from my point of view, it's just about the best job you can have in the military or the active duty or reserve. They put out a monthly newspaper, go in for the weekend, and also I actually would try to volunteer for some other days also. And I did a couple of good things. I remember going on some exercises. This was out of Niagara Falls. Going on some exercises like with our security police. Down to Arkansas, the air base that they have down there outside of Little Rock. Little Rock is called the Little Rock Air Force Base. And so anyway, I had it opened up some opportunities for me in the reserve. I got a job in 1985 working for New York State Health Department in Albany, and again in public relations, directly because of the training I started with in the Marines when I went to the journalism school, a job that falls under public affairs. And I transferred over to the 439th Airlift Wing in Chicopee, Massachusetts, Westover Air Reserve Base it's called now. And I was there up until last month. On March 1st, I stayed in. You can stay in the reserve up to your 60th birthday, and I stayed in. And I worked. I worked up till 2 days before my 60th birthday, writing stories for the base paper, the Patriot at Westover. When I first got there to Westover, it was C-130s, just like at Niagara Falls. And they later, what they call, transitioned over to C-5s, the Galaxy, which is the big airlifter, heavy airlifter. It can carry, if they want to, in wartime conditions, it can carry about 250,000 or more pounds of cargo, and it's for outsized cargo. And I've got a lot of fond memories of the C-5 Galaxy. And in the time that I really really came to appreciate being in Westover and what I was getting out of the reserve was in Desert Shield, Desert Storm. You know, I went there in '85, and in '90 it was when they activated us. I never really thought that we'd be activated, but of course it was August in 1990 that Saddam Hussein across the border into Kuwait. I remember hearing it on the radio, and I remember wondering if this would be as big as the just cause, as the problems we had had in Panama just the year before. And of course, here we are in 2008, and we're still involved. So it definitely turned out to be pretty big. In August 1990, within a couple of days, the first C-5s started carrying people over to Saudi Arabia when they made the agreements. I think it was within a week. I went to Westover. I volunteered in November, so to do 30 days. And I went on the first trip that November, carrying some of the first people. We went down to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. An airfield just outside of Fort Campbell, and we carried the 101st Airborne, first contingents of 101st Airborne people over to Saudi Arabia. The way you would do the airlift. I accompanied three times. I went over during Desert Shield, Desert Storm on C-5s. The third time I stayed in Saudi Arabia a week, and actually traveled around on a Black Hawk and a C-130 throughout that area. So I guess my combat experience is limited to about a week or so, and a few other odds and ends days over there. But the way they did it was they would fly from wherever you are in the U.S. You know, Dover, Delaware is the big C-5 place. Nobody flies directly even now into the Middle East. You fly over to Germany. At that time it was Ramstein and Rhein-Main being outside of Frankfurt. Now it's just Ramstein that they go out. At that time, I know they were also flying to Spain sometimes to spend the night. I know they still do. As a matter of fact, they fly to Rota, Spain now. They just set up a C-5 operation out of there. Westover did what they call a Pony Express operation, which informally they call a Pony Express operation. And what that means is you'll put a crew in an air base in Germany. You put a couple of crews in an air base in Germany or Spain. Plane flies over there. There's no sense in that. Now that crew has to get some rest. They've spent 7-8 hours in flight and a number of other hours getting ready for the flight. There's no sense in that airplane sitting there. You get a fresh crew, put that crew on the airplane and shuttle them what they call downrange, down into... I know in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, it was Bahrain, and Saudi Arabia. There was a base near Riyadh, and there we were at, and that's where I did spend a week there. And matter of fact, I made it into Riyadh, and it was just like in the movies. I remember I spent the night somewhere in Riyadh, and in the morning the sun was coming up, and it was like sand and stuff in the air, and they were calling the prayers from the mosques and everything, and it really was like in the movies. What I was doing was we had people permanently stationed over in Saudi Arabia. Again, this is Desert Shield, Desert Storm. And I spent some time taking pictures and interviewing them and sending things back to hometown newspapers and things like that. I went up, and we had some people who made some donations to the troops. And so to give them a little bit of publicity, they put these donations, I think it was some dental equipment and things like that. We put it on a Black Hawk, and we flew the Black Hawk up. This was just after they had pushed Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, and we went from Saudi Arabia, King Khalid Military City, they call it, which is a big base in northern Saudi Arabia, and we went up into a small air base in Kuwait to make this delivery of some of this humanitarian equipment that had been donated from Massachusetts. So I went along, take pictures, and wrote a story to send back to the Massachusetts papers about how their equipment was, their humanitarian aid was being used. It did fly over what they called the Road of Death, which was where it was just after the Iraqis had been pushed out of Kuwait City, and as they were going north from Kuwait City to Basra, they were being we were hitting their military vehicles, and they still had the vehicles all over. I know somebody said that there were still bodies that you could see down there. I didn't, but I did see a lot of carnage. Did see the smoke. We drove the burning oil wells, and we did come fairly close. Spent a couple of nights in Kuwait, and at night when it got dark, you could see the. You could go up on top of the buildings, and you could see the building where we were, and you could see the flames would start coming out of the burning oil wells. So that was my closest. I did see going around the airbase. Apparently, we had shot up this airbase when it was being used by Saddam Hussein. And what impressed me was about what an A-10 can do. The A-10. The A-10, the Warthog, came in firing, 50, I can't think of what they were, the big rounds, 50, it wasn't, 30 millimeter?
50 millimeter?
It's a round about this big, and all over the place you could see what they had done. You could walk down the street and you could see a hole every 3-4 feet. I remember walking through a building and seeing, you could see where it went through this wall, and scattered over on this wall. Where it just and all over the place there was, and this wasn't any big battle. And all over the place you could see shrapnel and metal just all over, as though it had snow. So it impressed me with what modern weapons can do. So let's see. Oh, then when I was over in Saudi Arabia, what I was doing is we had people who were organizing the airlift home of the army people. I remember seeing some French soldiers and I remember seeing the American. They were the 7th Corps, I think, the 7th Corps out of Germany. And our Air Force people were putting them on planes, a lot of commercial planes, and C-5 Galaxies, and for their equipment. And anyway, they were taking them back to Germany. A lot of the troops who were in Desert Storm had been in Germany, and. So I did make 3 trips overseas. I remember I went to Bahrain, which is an island right off of Saudi Arabia, a Navy base, and Saudi Arabia. The thing that was most impressed me was the summer of 1990, and that's when the war was in, I guess the actual fighting when they pushed them out of Kuwait was in March, and at some point not too long after that, the first people started coming home, and Westover is the largest. Is the closest big air base to Europe, according to the way you fly, in the U.S. There's a bigger one, Dover, Delaware. There's McGuire down in New Jersey, but we're and there's some smaller ones that are a little farther north, up in Maine. But we at Westover, really in a sense, we're on the front lines of Desert Shield, Desert Storm, in the sense that we were the closest to. Where people would go to be flying to Europe, and they could actually carry more cargo and everything else because they had to carry less fuel because of the than if you were going to say out of Dover, Delaware. So when they were coming back, we had 3,000 people who were welcomed home, 3,000 troops who were welcomed home from Desert Shield, Desert Storm, that began in the summer, and that began right after, must have been in March, right after the land fighting took place, after they pushed up into Kuwait City and everything. And that continued throughout the summer. It seemed to me it lasted until like July or August. And at first, because it was completely different from things are now, we didn't have this huge amount of security. The terrorists, we didn't have the terrorist threat that they have now. At first, we weren't letting anybody on base, and only people who had somebody, a relative coming home. And the General Walker, who was in charge of Westover, relented on that at some point. And first of all, it became obvious that a lot of people didn't actually have relatives. People were coming on base saying that they had relatives coming home. And the point is, people wanted to welcome the troops home. There hadn't been a war. Now, in 2008, I think people are war weary. We've been at war since 1990. But in 1990, there had been a long period of relative calm since let's say 1973, when the last of the ground troops were in Vietnam, and people were. Enthusiastic. I think there was support people thought that Saddam Hussein had taken Kuwait, so it was a kind of a simple, clear thing that people could understand. It wasn't a preemptive kind of war like the second invasion, of Iraq. People trusted the president more then than they do now. There was an enthusiasm, and they were more. It was something they could understand. They supported. I think they supported us going into Kuwait, liberating Kuwait. When the troops started coming home, in light of all that kind of pent-up patriotism and everything else, people went crazy. So at some point, the general said that every single person coming home, 3,000 of them came. It was going on day and night. A lot of commercial airplanes, actually, is the way they contract. We're flying into the big air base. We have like 2-mile-long runways and everything. It's a major air base, only 100 miles away from Albany, which actually people here in Albany didn't even know about it. But if you went to over to Westover, you'd almost feel like you were on the front lines of the war in the Middle East. People were walking around in desert uniforms. Literally, still having the dirt of Saudi Arabia, still having the sand on them. I know personally, coming home, still having all that sand on us. But in any case, the general said every person that comes back home is going to have a welcome home party, and that's what they did. They filled up a hangar, an Air Force hangar is a very large thing. They filled up that Air Force hangar. They got the veterans, the American Legion, these people. Some beer companies donated beer. They set up a bar with paper cups of beer. The planes would land. They put them on a bus. They bring them to the hangar. They, over and over again, they played that Proud to Be an American song and a few other songs like that. And it was just this incredible outpouring from the community. And the thing that I've been saying for years since then is that one thing that I learned from Desert Shield, Desert Storm is people want to participate in something bigger than them. They want to participate, they want to be part of a community and things like that. I think that with this, in this current war, they've completely missed actually bringing people into it. But there is a desire for people to do that, and the community just poured into that hangar. What we did was we set up ropes to kind of hold people back from swamping these guys. But a busload, let's say a 50 or 100 people, you know, some relatively small groups of guys, a few buses would bring them in. They'd come. We had a red carpet and. Actually, I think the red carpet at the end of the war was like cut up and given to people as souvenirs or something. But we had a red carpet that we wore out. They would lead up to the flight line where the bus was. They'd come down. The music would be pouring out. The crowd would be cheering. The kids and everything. And the guys would come in. They had a rec area for them. And as I said, they set them up. They had the paper cups of beer. The veterans from the Korean War and stuff were there. They had people coming in playing music. What I remember is a lot of veterans groups too. I remember there was one veteran who was coming in. He was doing magic tricks. And people just wanted to applaud these troops coming back. The nice thing from my point of view is that I could go behind that wire that, you know, they were holding all the civilians back. So going in there, I talked to the guys. I do stories. I talking to them about some of the things they had done, and just move around. We'd bring media in. A lot of the TV and news stations. And that went on for the whole summer in 1990s, and that was just a great positive experience. I do want to mention, I don't want to put that, kind of in balance. Before the guys started coming home, they were also going overseas, and the same thing happened, of course, without all going overseas before March. We got. I started serving in Westover in October 1st, but the wing itself was activated where everybody got called up by presidential order on December 2nd. So from then on until through the summer of 90, we were all at Westover on active duty. So before the war, we were sending people overseas. People were coming, from bases. A lot of planes would stop. They'd refuel, do a last-minute check before they last-minute maintenance check before flying over to Germany or Spain, going on down. And I remember working Christmas Eve. I remember working Christmas Day and Thanksgiving Day. And I remember on the planes, the kids would have their Christmas. The troops would have their Christmas meal. Some of them were cooked in these little convection ovens on the plane going over. So somebody was chipping in, and I remember they bought them a ham on Christmas Day. They got on the big plane. The C-5 has two galleys for with little convection ovens, but they cooked up. That's how these guys had their Christmas dinner. I very distinctly remember the Thanksgiving and Christmas walking around in the passenger terminal. Where they were loading up the airplanes and everything. And outside the gate, during the build-up time, we did have some anti-war protesters and things like that coming out, some people coming out. We have a big university there and stuff like that. And so while I said that overall most people were, in support of the war, unlike this thing that's going on now where people are so war-weary now, back then, but even then, there were a certain number of people who had some arguments against going using ground forces to push Saddam Hussein out. One thing that was said is that maybe an embargo would work or something like that. But in any case, what struck me was the difference between Vietnam and the anti-war protests of Desert Shield, Desert Storm. I think both sides learned a little bit. There wasn't nearly. I was actually walking around in uniform out there because we would have we had to be out there to kind of monitor the thing, because we would have news cameras out there and everything else taking pictures of the war protests. And it was almost like a gentleman's agreement among everybody that we were all going to just kind of get along and everything. It wasn't any of the confrontational kind of stuff like in Vietnam. There was a little bit of stuff. They blocked the streets once or twice. But I remember I was even being in uniform, I was able to talk to them. They were able to talk to me. And it wasn't like, you know, you think of like Vietnam where there was a conflict. It was closer to a kabuki dance where we're all going to agree that this is what you're going to do and this is what I'm going to do. And I remember walking through the crowds. We had a particularly big one, I think, at the time when the ground fighting first started, and they were out there. But I remember walking among all the people with posters and everything. I remember. One thing that we did was some of the protesters, we took pictures of them in case there ever was anything where people might try to get on the base. That was more of a precautionary kind of a thing. So that was Desert Shield, Desert Storm. And then there was the long stretch of the 90s where it seemed like we were always doing one thing or another. We were, you know, there was we sent. I didn't go over there, but we sent people over to Somalia. Some of the people from our office we sent to Haiti. It seemed like there were always things going on during. And of course, we sent a bunch of what we call our aerial porters over to Aviano, Italy, which is a Italian air base up in northern Italy, and that was for the. For Kosovo and Serbia and that whole series of operations over there. So it seemed like all during the 90s, between Westover C5s, 16 big galaxies were always being called out. And we had things like every time there was a earthquake in the Philippines or something like that, they were doing humanitarian relief. A lot of responses worldwide on these big airplanes. One of the things I remember about Desert Shield, Desert Storm, one of the things I always told people is I would do tours at a C-5. I'd say, when you want, you know, if you want to send something overseas and you want to save your money, you put it on a ship. If you want to send 100 tanks overseas, you're gonna put them on ships. But if you want a Federal Express and overnight, you're gonna put it on one of our C-5s because you can get to Germany in 8 hours and another 8 hours, what they call downrange. And we were constantly doing that during the earthquake thing that they had overseas. In any case,
you're not thinking of the tsunami.
Tsunami, okay. Yeah, the tsunami. We immediately sent people over there when we had a. Earthquake, when we had a hurricane in Florida at Homestead Air Force Base, we sent people down there. Classic example of what the C-5 did that I'm proud of is the air war started and we bombed Baghdad in, I think it was in late January or the beginning of February of 1990. The very next day on TV, you could watch on TV, Saddam Hussein was firing Scuds at Tel Aviv, and it was Westover plane that they actually had some Patriot missiles in Massachusetts, and they put some on the Westover plane. It was a Westover plane that took off the very next day and immediately flew aerial refueled and everything else, so that they didn't have to make any stops and flew right to Tel Aviv. With Patriot missiles and Patriot missile crews. I remember seeing it. I remember going in the plane, and they had this equipment. So that was a classic example of like an overnight response. When the special forces were killed, were attacked over in Somalia and Mogadishu in the 90s. They needed heavy equipment, and they immediately it was the Westover plane. And the point is, as I say. Westover, it's in the middle of Massachusetts, but it's actually on the front line of and people here 100 miles away in Albany don't know that, but it's on the front line of worldwide military things. It was a Westover C-5. I don't know where they flew to. They flew to an army base in the south, but they, or maybe it was Dover, Delaware, but they picked up armored equipment. The Ariel refueled all across the Atlantic and the Mediterranean and went down to Mogadishu. And they got that they got equipment down there within 24 hours, whatever it was. Then, okay, so that was the 90s. And then 2001, September 11, I was at Westover. I was working on a very boring thing. I had what they call an additional duty, working on training records for just to keep records of people who are training. I remember, and it's not a story, I remember thinking to myself, boy, I wish something would happen because I you know, just get an excuse not to have to bend over the desk working on these training records. And I was talking to somebody else, and they came in and they said that a plane had hit the World Trade Center, and we know the rest of it. You know, we spent that day. Actually, what happened was I was in my blue uniform, and they said, you know, we were watching on TV, watching all that stuff. They said, okay, we're now going on 24-hour operations, and they said, you're going to be staying in the office tonight, sleeping on the couch. And everything else. We don't know what's going on in the world. And went back to the uniform, went back to the barracks, took off the blue uniform, put on the green uniform, and we kind of all went to war. I made another trip over to where did I go? Kuwait in Saudi Arabia as part of Operation Iraqi Freedom. And out of that, I got a big medal, Kuwait Liberation Medal, a beautiful medal that someday I'll give to the nieces and nephews. I think I was a real war hero. But during Desert Shield, Desert Storm, during Operation Iraqi Freedom, of course, we've been in that up till now. We've been sending planes. And I've been interviewing people by telephone who are over in Afghanistan and Iraq. You know, again, from my point of view, best job in the world. I can sit at my desk, and it's amazing. They have DSN phone numbers. You can punch a few numbers in, and you can be talking to, I've talked to people in Kazakhstan as clear as I'm talking right now. So I was talking on the telephone to somebody in Schenectady, and that's what I've been doing on this this long war that we've been having since 2003, up until March 1st last month when I retired, turned 60.
When you were over there, did you have any opportunity to work with the commercial media?
We took media over there, and they were really great. They were enthusiastic with the TV stations. Including some Albany people, we took them over to Germany. Unfortunately, in this war, we couldn't get them down, what they call downrange in the Saudi Arabia, into Iraq. But we took them over to Germany, where they actually interviewed our medical people who were working with the wounded coming back, and that was a really sad story. I've interviewed a number of our medical people who had some, you know, it was a completely unsanitized version of war. They talked about kids severely brain damaged, kids with burned lungs, and everything else. The doctors and the nurses from Westover that I've talked to they were practically, some of them were just about in shell shock from some of the things that they saw. And what I always try to tell the kids is that the sanitized version you see on TV is just not true. When they were telling me about children with their arms blown off, and they were telling me about mothers who were picking up their sons, who the son would never get out of his hospital bed because of brain damage and everything else, and burned lungs and blindings and everything else. It's even the reservists over there got to see a real horror show.
Okay, well, we thank you very much for your service to our country and for doing this interview.
Thank you.